Hello, everyone.
I'm Kate Hennessy, and you're listening to Get Focused Radio. Stay with us for the next half hour, and let us inspire you and help you refocus when life gets in the way. Each week on Get Focused Radio, we'll bring you guests that have overcome challenges, guests who will inspire you, and guests who will share tools and techniques to help you create the life you desire. Connect with me after the show through Kate, Ask Kate Hennessy at GetFocusedRadio.com. Folks, today we've got a really special show for you. It is Nellie Olson Day here on Get Focused Radio. And I'll tell you, I was a big fan of Little House on the Prairie, but not so much of Nellie Olson. That girl made me so upset the way she treated people. And I know I'm not alone in that. But I'm here to tell you that actress Alison Arngrim, who played Nellie Olson, is nothing like that character. She is a loving and very courageous girl who is really making a positive difference in our world. And I am very proud to share her with all of the listeners today. Alison is best known to viewers worldwide for her portrayal of the incredibly nasty Nellie Olson on the much-loved, long-running hit television series Little House on the Prairie. And she continues to amuse audiences through her many film, television, and stage appearances. As a stand-up comedian, Alison has headlined at nightclubs such as The Laugh Factory, The Comedy Store, and The Improv in Los Angeles, as well as The Cutting Room in New York and assorted comedy venues all across the United States and Canada. In 1986, when her friend and Little House husband co-star Steve Tracy passed away due to complications of HIV, Alison immediately began volunteering at AIDS Project Los Angeles, and she continues to serve on that council today. She currently serves on the National Advisory Board of the National Association to Protect Children, and she's fighting to give children a legal and political voice in the war against child abuse. We are also going to talk about her new book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated. The book will touch your heart, and you'll want to give her a big hug, and you'll never think of her as mean Nellie Olson again, a guarantee. Before we get started, I want to share the call-in number with you. You can call in and ask Alison questions. The call-in is 1-888-435-1293 or 1-646-200-3268 and press 1. Without any further delay, Alison, welcome to Get Focused Radio.
Well, thank you.
I'm thrilled to have you on the show, and of course, as I told you before, our friend Sue London wanted to make sure to send out a big shout-out and to tell you that she says hello and knows that she's hoping to see you pretty soon. And we want to know when you're coming to Canada soon, too.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I have to get up there. It is... I am a Canado-American. My whole family are Canadian. I'm dual. I got the card.
You're dual. Well,
but,
and it's hot for you.
At some point.
Yeah, it's hot for you in Los Angeles. It's boiling here.
What is with this heat? And I just left New York, and everyone said I got out of town just in time. It was almost 100 degrees there the other day. It's at the East Coast. We're almost mild by comparison, and then it's hot here.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. You know, I must say, I just finished your book, and you've had quite a journey.
You were putting it mildly, right?
Wow.
I had to put it all in, you know?
I think you covered everything, and as we said before, some of the book is hard to read.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is a little squirmy, uncomfortable in my skin, and yet you just lay it all out there, and, you know, wow, that's amazing. I'm just so impressed that you were able to share everything, and I mean everything, folks. I encourage you to grab this book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated. It's just going to turn your head around. Can we talk a little bit, though, about life before Little House on the Prairie? Can you share a little bit? What were your early years like? You know, were you a child actress always?
Yes, actually. In fact, it's funny. You know, I just got my new SAG card because the union's merged. And my card, it says, you know, member since 1967.
Wow.
And whenever there's like a meeting of SAG people and people have to come in, show their cards, you know, meeting, you know, member since 1993, member since 1995, member since 1982, and they're like, wow. And once I was at a meeting where as people raised their hands, they had to identify themselves. They had to say, you know, John Smith, SAG member since 1988. And people got kind of show-offy. And if anybody was talking about a member since 1979, people, oh. And I raised my hand up to Allison Arger, member since 1967. And everybody went, gasp. And they said, good Lord, dear, were you playing a fetus? I mean, how old are, members of the 19, how old are you?
Like,
I mean, I look fairly young, and they're going, well, how old? And they're trying to calculate how old could she possibly have been and gotten the card. And good Lord, how old is that woman now? And I was like, okay, yes, I was 5, and yes, I am 50 years old now. But, yeah, I started doing commercials and working when I was a tiny, tiny little girl. And I thought everyone was on TV. I really did. My parents, my brother, my whole family, everybody we knew was on television.
Well, you were a showbiz family.
Well, it was very strange. My mother, you know, all the cartoons, I would turn on the cartoons, and they were all my mother. My mother did voiceover work. And she was the voice of Casper the Friendly Ghost. She was Sweet Polly Purebred, Underdog's girlfriend. She was Gumby, and she was Davy of Davy and Goliath.
No.
Yes.
I love Davy.
Exactly.
Davy.
And she thought that cartoon was really silly. She used to joke about it. You know, come on, Goliath, let's go outside and pray. And in you know, Davy and Goliath was done by Art Clokey, the same man who did Gumby. Very interesting.
Right, right.
And no. So she was everything. So everybody was on TV. And,
yeah.
And actually, it's funny because when I got Little House, I was already 11. It was technically my comeback. I had worked a lot at 6 and 7 and 8, and then I hadn't worked very much. I'd done a movie at 10, and it kind of stopped. And my father actually told me I wasn't really breaking out and working very much, and it might be over. I might be washed up and not work until after I was 18.
Wow.
So I was really kind of done. So actually, people talk about, you know, getting my start in early age. I said, oh, no, I'm on, like, my fifth comeback. Little House on the Prairie was my second career.
So, and how old were you when you started Little House?
I was 11. I just turning 12 when we started filming.
Okay. Okay. And now, can you tell, now, in your own home, you didn't do, sit-down dinners didn't happen in your house. I mean, your own house is very different. Your real-life home was very different from Little House.
Yes. We would try. It was always very funny. We tried. At one point, every now and then, my mother or my father would say, we should all eat at the table. It's good for you. They said, Jim, studies said we should all be eating dinner at the table at the same time. And then we'd go through the process of actually attempting to corral everyone to eat dinner at the same time at the table. And it sometimes worked. And we'd have flurries of this for several weeks. And then we'd go, oh, to hell with it. Because, I mean, everyone was so bonkers. It was the 1960s. Everything was completely insane. It was very chaotic and crazy.
Yeah.
And then people weren't home. People were always doing something.
Right.
So I said,
your
parents, now and again, we try to sit at the table, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you came from a family where mom was working, dad was working, and then you put on the Nelly hat, and you went off to work there. And,
mm-hmm.
and our preconception of that was that this was the perfect family. I mean, mom, pa, everybody all sat down and ate dinner at the table. And little even Nellie, she was with the Olsons. I mean, they all sat down with her brother. You know, that's what you did. They were very family-oriented on the show.
Right, exactly. And that's why being on Little House was so... It was such a change for me to be in this very structured environment and to see all these stories where everyone's being such a perfect family and acting like, yeah, this is a fantasy. you know, I meet people all the time who tell me that the reason they watch Little House and why they loved it is they wish that their family had been like that, that
right.
they didn't have a life like that, and they wished they had. And, you know, really it was the same. I didn't have a family life like that, so it was a complete departure for me.
Well, I don't think anyone did, even if you weren't in a showbiz family.
Right.
All the shows back then were, you know, the Brady Bunch and the Donny Osmond Marie show and the Waltons and all of that. Very, you know, most of us were sitting at the TV while our parents were doing their own thing, probably too much drinking and out and about and partying and all this. And we were sitting as little kids going, wow, look at that family.
Right,
that would
right.
be neat. Yeah.
And the fantasy is so seldom true. I mean, when you look at Little House, well, did not, you know, Michael Landon wound up getting divorced twice and married three times.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was no Little House in Caroline. It was, you know, nobody was having the perfect life. I mean, look at Marie Osmond. Marie Osmond has since come forward and talked about having depression and all sorts of terrible problems. So it's very often we watch TV and we think that people we see on TV have a perfect life. And it's extremely rare because, first of all, hardly anybody has a perfect life. And then secondly, really generally people who are drawn to being in entertainment have a screw loose.
Yes.
To put it simply, most people drawn to entertainment, there's something the matter with them they're trying to fix by being on stage or being on TV. So your odds that something terrible has happened to your person that you like on television are really high.
Well, I think the fact that each book, you know, you've written a book and other people have written books, and it's always a little bit of a almost a slap in the face for those of us who sat and watched those shows and fantasized about those that life, and then you read the book and go, oh, it wasn't like that at all. It was very much like my life.
Right? And, you know, I feel good in that I was able to at least tell people that as difficult things were for me, you know, with the physical and sexual abuse and everything I went through, that being on Little House was helpful, that Little House, this being on the set of Little House was wonderful, that the people on the show were really kind to me, and that the whole structured environment and the supportive attitude of everyone, that, you know, yes, you were right to watch Little House, and most of the people were very, well, this isn't Richard Bull, was Mr. Olson, we voted him most like his character, that there was that kind of camaraderie and family atmosphere amongst the actors, and that it was a very healing place. And
right.
So I'm glad I was able to tell people that was true, because people go, you know, please don't tell us that being on the show sucked. It's like, no.
Well, they don't
want to
hear all that. No. I mean, some want to keep that illusion alive. And it was to a point, right? I mean, it wasn't all chaos and whatnot. You had, now mind you, some of the characters were a little bit different in real life, because I remember watching the perfect Melissa Sue Anderson.
Oh,
she was perfect.
And, you know, Her hair was perfect. I'm sympathetic to her, because if I had to be that character, Mary, that perfect, that off, just really sanctimonious in some episodes, that sickeningly perfect and nice all the time, I'd probably flip out. I don't think I could handle it. I'm so glad I was Nellie Olson. If I had to be one of the nice girls, it would have driven me nuts. And I think that having to be that perfect, and I think she also had a kind of a stage mother who wanted her to be very perfect. And I think that pressure really bothered her, because, man, did she let us have it. I mean, Melissa Gilbert and I, we became friends right away, which is really crazy, because here we were playing mortal enemies, Laura and Ellie, and we hit it off. Something to chemistry. We were hanging out at each other's houses. We just became like sisters. And then here's Melissa Sue, is her sister, and we're like, oh, hey, you want to hang out with? No. And she acted as if basically Melissa Gilbert and I were filthy juvenile delinquents and she didn't wish to be seen with us. And we're just going, is it something we said? And I mean, yeah, as an adult I look back and it's like, yeah, you always have the one teenage girl who's like the homecoming queen, who's the cheerleader, who's going to be like that. And then also as an adult I look back and I go, okay, if I had to play that character and I had to live her, man, I probably would have been in a bad mood.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, now, you did try, though. I know, Queen's book, you tried later in life, and I think everybody has done this, where you've had almost a nemesis or someone that was horrible to you younger when you were younger, and you see them later on. You're grown up. You're mature.
Right.
You're going to try and see if maybe it was all just, you know, something that just didn't click back then, but now you're grown up. You can be buddies now.
Right.
But that didn't happen for you, Melissa.
I did. I tried to start a little conversation at Michael Landon's funeral, and it was absolutely no sale. Very polite, but very cool. I was like, oh, what a beautiful baby. How old is she? 6 months. And it just absolutely just got nowhere. And that's the thing is that, yeah, and she's got her book out and everything, and if you read it, there is this very sort of cool, this is how much I'm going to tell you, and that's it. See you later. Have a nice day, pal. And
oh, okay. I have to get that because she doesn't share.
That's the thing is, I tell everyone, get all three books. You know, don't take my word for it. Go get Melissa Sue's book. Go get Melissa Gilbert's book. And read all the stories from all the different perspectives. But indeed, she was not into the idea of being pals. And it's funny, because I've had luck with that. I have had people who, when I first met them, we didn't get along.
Mm-hmm. Was that in this show or other shows?
Oh, and in other shows. And, and there were people who I just, you know, didn't get along with when I first met them. And then I later met up with them, and we wound up talking and wound up becoming best friends.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's very funny. I have hilarious stories about people. My friends are like, oh, yeah, remember when we were driving in the car and you said, get out of my car now. And it's like, wait, what? I was like, oh, yeah, we didn't quite start out as friends. And so I've had people who were like mortal enemies who I'm friends with now. So I see nothing wrong with that. It can work out.
It can work. You should write, that's your next book. My mortal enemies are now my best friends.
Oh, yeah, there's all sorts of people. Oh, God, this guy Jim, a good Canadian guy. I remember we first met. And, yeah, a bunch of people I knew were in a theater group with him. And, oh, we did not get along. I don't know how we got off on the wrong foot. Couldn't stand one another. And then, like, 2 years later, we met. We wound up going out to the movies together and hanging out and meeting all of each other's friends. And I was like, wait, didn't you two hate each other? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of course.
It was like we'd gotten some wrong impression of each other. And we worked it all out and thought it was hilarious. And
that's
so, yeah,
fun.
I've had that happen lots of times. It can work out. The only problem is it doesn't always. We sometimes we put enormous pressure on ourselves to be perfect, to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And we know that it can sometimes work. That we hear these stories that people who were just, they hated each other, they later became friends, and we go, that'd be great. And we want to be able to say we're that incredibly spiritual person who can do this. Well, yeah, sometimes the other person doesn't want to play.
That's right, of course.
And sometimes it isn't meant to be. So we sometimes put terrible pressure on ourselves that we're going to forgive everybody, we're going to make up with everybody, and, you know, hey, give it a shot. But sometimes it really doesn't work and it can't happen. So you have to go, well, I'll say I gave everybody a shot.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes it'll work and sometimes it won't. But you can't just say, well, I'm being a bad person that I haven't gone back and created a loving relationship here. Nah, you probably tried. So, chill.
Yeah, exactly. And when you're a child actor, I mean, it's very difficult to make those bonds. You're having different actors in and out, and you come from different spaces. You have different backgrounds. It's just real life, but not.
And as a child actor, you're encouraged not to be their friend. Competition is the word of the day. Some of the stories you hear about, like Macaulay Culkin, he wasn't allowed to play with other kids on shoots. His father was sort of, you are the star, you can't talk to them. And many child actors are very separated from their friends and from other people. The parents get into their head, they're a great star, and everybody's beneath them, and it's really unfortunate. I kept all my friends from school. I continued to go to school and hang out with those people and make friends. But there's terrible competition. And we were pitted against each other in Little House. I talk about that in the book, that some of the stage mothers were so competitive, they would start rumors about other. I mean, it's one thing to start a rumor about another actor on a show, but to start rumors about children. These are grown women starting rumors about other people's children to try to get them fired.
Now, was your mom stage mom?
My mother barely set foot in the place. I think my mother visited the set like 3 times. And she was working, was like, that's nice, you got a show. My father came to the set a few times, since he was indeed a manager, and so he's my manager, he came by. But even he was like, I'm not going out to Simi Valley, I'm not going out to that location, ugh. My Auntie Marion was assigned to me. This wonderful, my Aunt Marion, my mom's sister, I talk about taking me to the set, and that thing, she was retired, so I said, well, you're taking the set. So I had a stage aunt, but she was the most unstage mothery person on earth. She was wonderful.
Right.
And my father really, I guess technically, was a stage parent, but the thing is, as a manager, he had tons of other clients. So
right.
He wasn't totally focused on me. I wasn't his sole source of income, and I wasn't his only client. He'd say, well, that's nice, you're having a bad day. I'm busy, I got a guy making a picture over here, I'm going to his set. So I wasn't the sole focus.
You didn't
and
have the same pressure.
And I did see so many of these people where the mothers were there 24/7, and that kid was the sole source of income. And it was the sole focus of attention, and it was brutal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's now. Who was your favorite actor to work with on that show?
Melissa Gilbert, and then
yeah.
I guess close second be Steve Tracy, who played my husband Percival.
Yeah. Now, did you stay friends when the show was over with Melissa?
Indeed, and it's funny actually say because if you watch the show, you remember there was Mrs. Foster, the postmistress.
Yes.
The little old lady in the post office. Well, Ruthie Foster, who was a dancer for years and an actress, she was on Bonanza, and then we wound up on Little House. She just died recently. She was in her 90s. And she actually kept dancing till quite late, was in a show for older dancers. Well, she just passed recently, and there's a big funeral this weekend. And you know everyone's going. Melissa Gilbert sent the email and said, okay, we're all meeting over here, and then we're all going for food after this restaurant. And, oh, Karen Grassley won't play. She's flying in. Now, who's picking her up at the airport, and who's driving her back?
Oh,
and
that's wonderful.
Just as an extended family, you know, the great aunt has passed, and we're all going to her funeral. Everyone is calling each other and talking about who's giving who a ride to the funeral.
Oh, that's awesome. And when is that?
It's this weekend, and it's absolutely, it's like a family event. I mean, and I talk to Melissa all the time. We're on Facebook, so we're constantly commenting on each other's pages and saying rude things to each other. And we follow each other, and on Twitter, we've had fake Twitter wars every now and then. We say, well, wouldn't it be funny if we pretended to have a fight like Laura and Nelly on Twitter and see what everyone does? So we'll start insulting each other on Twitter, see what everyone, have everyone become hysterical.
Now,
we went to we're at the age where we're having all our medical exams and tests, so we talk about how you must get your mammogram and you must get your colonoscopy. Melissa went for a colonoscopy, and she was talking about on Twitter, I have to go for a colonoscopy. And I said, well, do you need a ride there and back? She can't really drive home, you know, with the drugs and everything. She said, oh, great. So I took her, and we took pictures of her, you know, going in and coming out and everything, and discussed the colonoscopy on Twitter. And when she was done, they gave her a wheelchair because, you know, they won't let you leave a hospital without a wheelchair, even if you're fine. And she said, oh, good, I don't need a wheelchair. And then they said, no, no, you have to sit in the chair. And as soon as she got in the chair, she goes, oh, no. And we realized it's like the episode where she pushed me down the hill in the chair. So we took pictures of me pushing her in the wheelchair, and we put them up on Twitter and Facebook.
That's
hilarious. Yeah, you know, we're grown women. We're middle-aged women. We're still doing goofy stuff like this. It's yes.
Well, now here's something that really intrigued me. I didn't know this, and I have my dirty little secret is, even as a very young girl, I had a huge, huge crush on Michael Landon. Huge.
Okay, everyone.
When I read,
you and everyone, yes.
Oh, yeah. I read this, and if I had known this, I would have been looking at him a whole lot differently, a lot harder, actually.
You've been watching the scenes where Paul runs down a hill in slow motion.
Oh, you bet.
I'm
telling because you said that he didn't wear underwear and he wore tight pants.
Not a stitch. It was the 70s, and guys were wearing the tight jeans and no underwear and the open shirt and the gold chains. Look, this was very popular. And he saw no reason to alter this just because he was
Pa. I could never say, oh, Pa.
Underwear. What is going on this show?
Where are your pants, Pa?
Right? Pa, you left your drawer somewhere. And I was like, oh, my God. But that's the thing. Everybody had a crush on him. And he knew it. And he knew people were tuning in because he was gorgeous. And
oh,
so
he was.
He's taking his shirt off, and he's wearing a tight fancy, and wear underwear.
Always had his shirt off, too. He always had that shirt off.
Every time he got hurt, it was always his ribs.
Yes, that's right.
Did he ever break an ankle? No.
No. He had the bandages around, and they slowly wrapped those ribs.
And that shirt would just stay off for days. And he was always shirtless. He was always chopping wood shirt. Didn't it ever get cold?
No, not for
you know,
Pa,
I've
apparently.
Been to Minnesota. It's cold. People in Minnesota don't go running around with their shirts off all day.
Now, I want to make sure, just while we've got the listeners here, I want you to just tell us, where is the website that they can go to get your book? And tell me that now.
Well, indeed, I'm all over the place. Your first stop absolutely is Amazon. .com. You go to Amazon, and sure enough, you look up Alison Argermore, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated.
Perfect.
And it's for sale on Amazon. On my own website, which is now hgd.com/Alison, the fabulous Howie Green Design presents it. And he's actually got a thing of it. He says, order book now. You can order on Amazon. You can order it on Barnes & Noble. You can order it at Borders. You can order IndieBound. And if you want to get an autograph copy, the great thing is, first of all, I'm all over the country. I'm going to be everywhere. I'm going to be at Laura Palooza in Minnesota, in Mankato, in July, the second week
in July. Okay.
Yeah, July, from July 12th through 14th, I will be at Laura Palooza in Mankato, Minnesota. They have I love the name, Laura Palooza. It's all
Laura
Palooza. It's a very literature-focused event. Then the next week, and I'm in Walnut Grove up the street, doing Prairie Days, and I'm going to be signing books at all of those, and then I'm heading over to Wisconsin to Heritage Hills. I'll be there, and then I come back, and then I'm in Michigan, then I'm in Wisconsin again, then I'm in Chicago, And it's the schedule's up on my website.
That's all on the website, right? Your schedule
it's on the
for
website.
The next,
it's, yeah, the HD.com. And I've got it up on Amazon and Facebook. I'm on Facebook. I'm on everything. And
okay,
under
perfect.
Events on Facebook. But the Laura Ingalls Wilder Museum in Walnut Grove, they, of course, stock my book fully. They make sure they have lots of them. And they do a marvelous thing where if you order from their website at walnutgrove.org,
mm-hmm.
They have a whole shopping thing where you can order books and things online. And if you order my book, you can request that it be signed. And they'll ship it out to me wherever I am, and I'll sign it and ship it back to them.
Perfect.
So
Walnutgrove.org.
Yeah. Walnutgrove.org.
Okay.
If you're somewhere that I'm not coming to in the next couple of months, which is pretty difficult because I'm everywhere, but if you're somewhere I'm not, you can go to walnutgrove.org, and they'll get you a signed copy.
You'll get a signed copy. So that's fantastic. I want to talk a bit about, I know because it's very close to your heart and you work on the committees, the loss of your Little House husband and your best friend, Steve Tracy. Can you tell us about that? I know you were extremely supportive with him. In the book, it'll bring you to tears because you were with him through it all.
It's true. My friend Steve, you know, played Percival. The character, when your husband and wife on TV, and in a great setup they had with Nellie and Percival, it was like Taming of the Shrew and everything. When your husband and wife on TV, you either adore each other or you can't stand each other. A lot of people married on TV can't even stand to be in the room with one another. But we hit it off, and we were the kind of married couple on TV who become best friends in real life. And he was just the nicest person, and such a wonderful actor.
He seemed so nice. His persona came across the screen.
It's so sweet. All of that warmth and sweetness, he's absolutely just the most wonderful person and so funny. So we became very good friends. And so when he got sick, you know, there he is, 1985, he went public with his AIDS diagnosis. In the 80s, nobody did that.
Yeah.
And here he was, this guy who'd been a Little House in the Prairie telling people he had AIDS. And it was awful for me because I was very young and there was nothing they could do. It's not like now where there's 87 different drugs and if one doesn't work, you can at least try another. And there's nothing. And he got so sick so fast. It was horrible. And he was so young. And he kept saying,
How old was he?
32. And he kept saying, I'm going to fight this. And I was like, yeah, but no, because at that time, people with AIDS tended to die in about 9-10 months.
Mm-hmm.
If you lived a year, it was a big deal. And he lived like almost 2 years from diagnosis. And now that's terrible. Back then, that was pretty good if you lived that long. Now people are diagnosed with AIDS and they live, you know, 10 and 20 years if they get on the right drugs. But here he was, and he was, you know, 2 years, and he was so ill. I mean, and he was so proud. I mean, he'd fall down and you couldn't help him up. He was so weak and sick, but he's like, no, I got it.
Yeah.
And very self-sufficient. So I did what I could to help him, but that's the thing, he was very self-sufficient. And then as I started volunteering, I saw most people weren't as well off as he was. They hadn't been on TV, so they didn't have any health insurance, and they didn't have any cash. And his mother and his sister stood by him and, like, flew out from Florida to help him. People's families were abandoning them right and left.
Yeah.
So when I saw this was going on...
Don't forget, that was a stigma back then. It was an actual reality where people thought if you went too close to people who had AIDS, you might get it.
They thought people were going to get it off the doorknob.
Yeah.
It was
we were so
misinformed.
Insane.
And people were just frightened out of their wits. And so as I saw this, I began volunteering, trying to help all these people who didn't have his resources. And then also to educate people via the hotline, go, no, you're not going to get it off a doorknob. No, go visit your sick friend and take them something to eat, for God's sake. And trying to help people. And I was able to do that. And, yeah, when he died, I knew there was not much other possibility at that point. But to see someone that young, someone who was that full of life, die, it was just awful. And it really affected me. And he was so brave. I mean, he was doing experimental treatments, and he said, they won't save me, but they might save someone else later. And
to see
someone with that kind of attitude, it was just
amazing. Well, Allison, I'm telling you, this is not enough time. Half hour has gone by like that.
Instantly.
You've got to come back on.
Okay.
I want to talk more about the book, more about the things in it. I want to talk about what you're still doing with the AIDS projects and whatnot. And you are inspiring.
Do tell them to go over to protect.org, too.
Protect.org, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? You are a gift. And I'm so absolutely honored to talk to you today, and I will talk to you again.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Allison. And I just want to tell everybody that, remind you that one organ donor can save up to 8 lives.
Yes.
And you need to go to www.beadonor.ca. And it's today can mean a new life to someone tomorrow.
I got
on behalf
sticker
of
on
my
license.
Guest,
do
you?
I got a,
good
yeah,
girl.
I got a sticker on my license. Totally.
You've got to register it. You've got to do that because then it's registered and you're an actual donor.
Cool.
On behalf of my guest, Allison Arngrim, and myself, Kate Hennessy, we wish you an amazing day. We'll see you all next week. Thanks so much, everyone.